Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Well, welcome everyone to this Federalist Society Courthouse Steps Decision webinar. Today, April 9th, 2021, we're covering the Supreme Court's unanimous decision in FCC versus Prometheus Radio Project. I'm Nick Marr, Assistant Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that expressions of opinion on our call today are those of our experts. I'm very pleased to be joined by a great panel, and they cover the oral arguments in this case. They're back to cover the decision, and so we thank them for their time. I'm just going to introduce our moderator, and he'll take it from there. We're joined again this afternoon. We're very pleased to be joined by Mr. Larry Spiewak. He's the president of the Phoenix Center for Advanced Legal and Economic Public Policy Studies. He's also an executive committee member of our Federalist Society Telecommunications and Electronic Media Practice Group, the sponsor of this event today. So with that, Larry, thanks for being with us. I'll give the floor to you.
Thank you very much, Nick, and thank you everybody for joining us. So we really appreciate it. Today, as Nick said, the topic of our conversation is Courthouse Steps Decision, FCC versus Prometheus Radio. We are once again privileged to have join us. Jane Mago is a former general counsel of the FCC. Chris Wright, another former general counsel of the FCC. And Mike O'Reilly, who's a former commissioner of the FCC. And me, telecom gadfly. But anyways, thank you all. We had done, just as a quick bit of background, last January 19th, literally the day before the inauguration, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in the case of Prometheus Radio. To make a very long story, hopefully short, the case involved the FCC's almost 19-year-old struggle to modernize its media ownership rules pursuant to Section 202 of the Communications Act. To summarize very briefly, basically the case of Barr, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, and not just the Third Circuit, but the exact same panel of judges for all those years. In this case, when the case we call it Prometheus 3, held that the FCC had failed to consider the effect of deregulation on women and minority ownership in its last go round, and that in particular that the FCC could not move forward until it produced new studies that satisfied the court. So later that week, all of us on this panel right here, we held a webinar to discuss what we could glean from the oral arguments. And, you know, based on the briefs, this case could have raised a wide variety of issues, which made it so fascinating. It involved the bounds of the FCC's public interest authority, whether the FCC is bound to consider women and minority ownership under 202H, what does it take to satisfy the arbitrary capricious standard on the APA, questions of judicial review. And the conversation was excellent. We really enjoyed ourselves. And we generally came to the consensus that based on the questions that we heard the justices ask, none of us had any idea how the court was going to rule. It could have gone all over the place. It was interesting. Plus, actually, it's still, you know, very much COVID. So it was done by a conference call. But none of us had any idea. Well, last week, the court reached a unanimous decision, and now we know what the court ruled on. And it turned out that rather than touch all of these issues of the public interest authority and whether or not the FCC had to consider women minority ownership, they issued a very, very narrow ruling, which is probably why they were able to get a 9-0 decision. And the decision was authored by Justice Kavanaugh. Echoing a piece that he, I guess an earlier case, I forgot it off the top of my head, that he had written when he was on the D.C. Circuit. But basically what he said was, it just focused exclusively on the arbitrary and capricious question and the related issue of judicial deference. And what he said was basically the case it's a very deferential standard, and the court reaffirming the idea that a court may not substitute its judgment for that of an agency. That, of course, opens up a whole bunch of interpretive questions going forward. So what I hope to do today is talk about two general themes. First theme will be how this case impacts administrative law generally, and in particular, drawing on the expertise of our distinguished panel today, how that affects agency decision-making, particularly at the FCC, because that's where we all work. And then what comes next in the quadrennial review, because that's still very much on the table. So let's move now to the first sort of broad area, which is what I would call questions of administrative law. So I'd like to open this up with sort of address it to our two former FCC general counsels, and they're looking with dread at me here on the Zoom meeting here. So let me get Jane and Chris, let me give you a hypothetical. And I'm sure that you have faced this conundrum multiple times during your respective terms. You're sitting in your office, and yes, I can still say in the eighth floor because that's when you guys were there. Back right after our last meeting, the Tom Bielli had said, like, I can't believe Larry mentioned the eighth floor. It's now the 10th floor. I'm like, hey, eighth floor forever, guys. Right, Mike? There you go. So sitting in your office, and we're going through the process of reviewing a draft order. And we know that the draft order is both highly political and, how should we put it this way, a case of first impression. In other words, we know we're really pushing the boundaries here. And I have no doubt that both Chris and Jane, this is not unfamiliar territory for you guys on more than one occasion. So you've got this. And, you know, look, that's naturally given the fact that the Communications Act is almost 90 years old. And, you know, it's tough to fit a square peg in a round hole. So here's the first thing, right? Under established case law, and I think the court still upheld this point, an agency still has to show its whys and wherefores, right? I don't think that Prometheus stands for the fact that the FCC has a blank slate. So you still have to show your whys and wherefores to pass arbitrary and capricious muster. But Justice Kavanaugh, and he was really adamant in the decision, he mentioned several times that the arbitrary and capricious standard was highly deferential. So if you know you've got, how should I put it, the ref working on your side, so to speak, you know you now have an advantage, I think we can say this. What are your thoughts going, like, you know, how rigorous does an agency have to be to show its whys and wherefores? I mean, what would you be looking for going, all right, I know the presumption is in my favor, so what do I really need to do here? Jane, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think you kind of nailed it there. I mean, you have to look at the order, and you have to keep the standard in mind. And the words that I wrote down of what Justice Kavanaugh said was that he said that the agency had to be reasonable and that its decision had to be reasonably explained. Now, throw deferential onto that, and it seems to me that it's got an awful lot of wiggle room. When I was general counsel, I remember I had a rule that I called, you had to have the more than two sentences. We had a particular issue that had come up, and came up any number of times. And when you reversed as not having had enough explanation, it was when you had less than two sentences that tried to explain what you were talking about. So it seems to me here that one of the things that you need to do is to truly cover the waterfront when it comes to the evidence that's in front of you. And that came up in this case too. There was some question about some of the studies that the Prometheus folks said the agency hadn't taken care of, hadn't looked at. The court said they did good enough. And that's always going to be a judgmental standard.
Chris?
So that's right. And you know, we used to run seminars for the people in the commission who actually write the decisions. Jane was involved in that while I was there, and no doubt after I left. And you know, that was the rule. I sort of hesitated to explain how much deference a court was likely to give the commission, but the rule was, look, you got a hard issue, you've got a question of statutory interpretation, let's say, you've got a question of which way the evidence weighs in this particular case. You got to wrestle with it. You got to wrestle with it in the text. You got to show your work. You know, two sentences sure does sound like too little to do anything other than a kind of an ipsy dixit. But part of the point was, look, if you take at least a fair look at both sides of the argument, acknowledge that there is something to the side you're about to reject, but then explain why the commission chooses to make the interpretation it does or the policy choice it does, you know, you ought to get upheld. And actually, we'd done a study in the early 90s that showed that actually there were a lot of reversals that were largely just based on sort of refusing to acknowledge that the commission was changing position. So we were emphasizing the idea that, look, the commission can change position, but it's got to acknowledge that it's doing so. And if you pretend you're not changing position, and therefore don't explain why you're changing position, at that point in time, the DC Circuit was, you know, striking the commission's orders down left and right for that, and, you know, as it ought. On the other hand, you know, we've got a system where the, as the law stands, the commission gets a fair amount of leeway in interpreting the Communications Act and in choosing among competing arguments as to what, you know, in the broadcast area, for instance, best satisfies the public interest, and it ought to get deference. I am a little worried about how far the deference went here in terms of encouraging agencies, you know, not to collect data. I'm sure your hypothetical is we've been presented with an order. I'm sure Jane and I both had the experience of working with the chairman earlier in the process, and sort of like, okay, we've got this rulemaking going. We don't have the order. We've got various submissions. How do we make sense of all of this? What do we ask for? And, in this case, of course, we do have we had a Third Circuit decision that, you know, that said that the commission's analysis sort of flunked, would have, you know, got a failing grade in an introductory statistics course because the commission just said, well, the numbers went down and then they went up and didn't even take a look at sort of, did the percentage change? Was the gradual recovery of ownership numbers by members of minority groups and women simply the result of an increase in number of stations, or, you know, what's going on here? It was very cursory. The commission complained in its brief that the other side was demanding regression analyses. Regression analysis wouldn't be a terrible thing, but certainly looking at percentages rather than numbers were. And, you know, Justice Kavanaugh's paragraph, to be sure, always a giveaway, in assessing the effects on minority and female ownership, the FCC did not have perfect empirical or statistical data, you know, far from it. But then he goes on to say, well, geez, they asked for data and they didn't get any great data, and the data they got wasn't perfectly clear. And so they were justified in choosing one way or another to go. And I can't remember whether we misused this following phrase when I was there, but it seems like every agency, and the FCC certainly among them, now knows that if they frame something in the sense of a predictive judgment, that often has the effect of triggering deference from the court. But, you know, it's sort of like, geez, we've got bad data. We haven't done any hard work to make the data better. We're just going to make a predictive judgment that bad things won't happen if we do what we want to do. And Jane and I would never be sitting in the office of the chair saying, look at, you're better off not collecting data because you might not like it. But, you know, I don't know, this decision would encourage agencies to do that on some occasions, at least.
Larry, can I jump in here? Because if I also read, you know, if I read the decision, though, the court is saying the 202H has no requirement for the commission to conduct the studies. And so that, to me, you know, there is this, you know, your point is that you should have a full record and commission has, you know, and maybe in your time you wanted them to do certain things, but there is no built-in obligation to do that. They look at the record as presented and they make a judgment, and we made a judgment at the time. I think the court, as much as I agree with Larry on so much, it's a narrow decision, but it's so, you know, expansive in terms of finally answering our long national nightmare is ending. I think if I look at this, you know, in terms of what it's decided. I mean, I don't see how you can go back to the Third Circuit and have any, you know, have any claim to jurisdiction for the Third Circuit. So to me, that throws them out. You're going to get to that later?
Okay. Oh, absolutely.
All right. Well, I think to get to your point, though, Larry, you know, in terms of an agency, I think it did provide the zone of reasonableness, right? That's been used in a lot of proceedings and a lot of decisions. And I think the commission fully went through its obligation. So many items that we had to vote on and consider didn't have much of a record. And what are you supposed to do in those instances? Is it on the agency's obligation to go conduct its own survey every time or study? And what I read from the court is saying, absolutely not. It's not built into the statute. And it's not, you know, your obligation is to look at the record as it is. And I think that's huge for the commission.
I mean, and now I was going to end it, but before I do get to that exact point, because I think you've hit on a really important thing, but let me just to follow up on my first question and then just modify the hypothetical, then we'll get exactly what you talked about, Mike. All right, so here's the second part of my hypothetical, Jane and Chris. You've now finished your term in service, of public service, and now you're sitting there as K Street lawyers, and I realize, Jane, you're in Florida, but Chris is a K Street lawyer, and now you have to challenge him more. Okay, so this is the second part. And I'll give you a great example where, you know, the court is given great deference, but I use an example of the net neutrality cases that have come up, both in U.S. Telecom and in the Mozilla case. I think are classic examples. And that was not a case where there was a shortage of a record, right, Mike? That was definitely not the case. but in those cases, you know, how should we put it this way? You know, in Mozilla, I know, Chris, you actually represented them, but, you know, one of the people just made up their data and the court looked at it and said, uh-oh, math, I'm a generalist judge. I give up, great deference, right? And so people are expecting or they're hoping that, you know, the wise and appellate court will go, FCC, you're really messed up here, right? And sometimes a judge will do that, sometimes not. You know, it's a fine line, but, you know, one of the frustrations, I mean, look, I freely admit, you know, I'm in the business of producing economic law and economic research. But sometimes when you do this, sometimes the court's like, uh-oh, math. So don't you have, I mean, where again, you want a strict review, but not to substitute the judgment of the court. So does that help the FCC? I mean, are we really expanding the agency's power here? In other words, you know, you've got a presumption of reasonableness, so to speak.
So look, I thought one of the changes in the recent, you know, under the Chairman Pai and Commissioner O'Reilly was to, you know, expand the technical expertise of the commission. And I forget what the office is called, because I guess I think of it as the office.
It'll always be OPP.
OPP. Or whatever
OPP,
it's called.
OSD, you know, something.
But the idea.
I still use the phrase common carrier bureau. I refuse to change. Yeah. So you know, right there.
So what should agencies do and what should agencies be encouraged to do? And I think agencies should be encouraged to beef up their statistical analysis capabilities and their economic analysis capabilities, and do as professional a job as possible. And the leadership of the agency ought to pay attention to the professional opinions that come to them, whether they meet their existing expectations or not. And that's what we hope our agency should do, no matter what party's in charge. And so that's good. I worry that this decision, though, it kind of encourages the opposite. I mean, if instead of looking at it in this way, you say, well, I just want to do what I'm going to do, and I'll be better off if I just don't look at that, don't get that bad data and don't look at it. So that's my concern.
See, I don't think that that's really a concern, especially for the agency that I grew up in, if you will. I think that there was always an effort to try to figure out what was the right answer and what was there. And the staff on the agency is an extraordinarily professional group that I think does a very good job. I don't think what the court said here is an indication that you should simply, pretend that none of that exists over there. I think what they said was you can't create a standard that says that's impossible to ever change these rules, which is essentially what they were really suggesting you happened here, is that if you have something where you keep requiring the agency, you must get this, you must get this, you must get that, that's not what the APA requires, and it's not what 202H requires, and I think that's what the court said.
I would agree to Chris's point, though, and I, in terms of OEA, what's now referred to as an OPP, if I wish it would do anything to what you described in terms of cost benefit analysis, and during my time it is just awful. And I don't see any, suggestion that it's going to improve anytime soon. The math that was done in those parts of the proceeding are just absolutely atrocious. And that's no disrespect to the staff. Oftentimes they're required to, crank out the document in X amount of time. But there is where I love some empirical, analysis, and have begged the outside world to help fulfill the record. To judge Kavanaugh's point, the outside party could certainly, outside parties could certainly amplify that, and then really, then the commission has something before it to consider. But it's been, it's just awful, and I don't see it getting, improving anytime soon. And this says to me that this, to Larry's point, this says to me, you didn't have an obligation to do a statutory. There was no, requirement to do these studies that the court was basically mandating you do the change points, and you couldn't do because it had its own agenda. So I think that's both good and bad. And I agree with Chris's concern. It's not probably going to get any better on some of that.
Well, let's build on that, because that's exactly where we wanted to go, the practical aspects of this, particularly if you practice in front of the FCC. I mean, as we talked about, I think the court was very upfront that they gave the commission a lot of credit for trying to make lemonade out of the lemons that it had. And I don't know whether you can distinguish the case or not. And it always reminds me, going to your point, Mike, when I've talked to former chairman of Ajit Pai, he actually said this publicly, look, I've got to deal with the record that's presented. So if it's garbage in, it's garbage out. And I know that you and I have talked for years, Mike, about the lack of an adequate record at the FCC. I mean, I knew when I was a staffer there, it still continues. I mean, during a lot of the major cases, rather than do serious work, there was an emphasis on clicktivism, where you'd have 10,000 people file email comments going, I don't like this rule. And then chairman at the time would go, I've got 10,000 people. I'm like, well, how do you write a defendable order on, clicktivism? But that's where they put the emphasis. I mean, I think it sort of goes to the nature of the administrative process now, which I think is sad, on how you do that. So let me ask you, sort of following up to that, I mean, one, do we think this case can convince the industry that, you know, maybe good work is important? I mean, we've talked about this for years, Mike, and yet everybody's like, we got this. It's a political thing. And yet they don't realize you've got to write, and, you know, staff has to write an order. And yeah, I got this because you might think you've got the votes, doesn't, on the eighth floor, or whatever it is now, doesn't mean you can write a sustainable order. And then, you know, building on what you said, Mike, you know, you have OPP now, Office of Economic Analysis, whatever they call it now. And the commission over the years has, you know, tried to step up. You know, I know from personal experience, sometimes when the results end up, maybe those studies never see the light of day. But they have tried to put out over the years, going back to the old OPP working paper series, do some research. As a former commissioner, Mike, I mean, how does this, you know, how does this affect? Does the agency have any impetus to do any more of its own research? It's, you know, kind of, what do you think this means for that, just on a real world basis?
Well, look, I applaud, you know, former Chairman Pai for beefing up OEA and creating what it exists today. I pushed for it as well. You know, I thought it was worthy of a bureau kind of to the FTC, you know, structure. But I think, you know, the hard part is you can have all the apparatus you want, but how do you get parties to, you know, and to your point, how do you get parties to want to file and do the due diligence? And that's just, you know, a tough one, except for two or three major items that everyone already knows about. The rest of the items have very, you know, paltry records to go off of. And I used to read the comments, and you're like, wow, this is really tough to kind of figure out the landing spot. You know, but that, you know, so I think the decision is, you know, gives the commission more deference, and then we'll have to deal with that. But, you know, I do worry that, that OEA and they're going to continue, they're doing some of their papers. So a lot of the early papers are confirming what they're already, you know, we're already headed towards. What I was interested in, and I'll tell you, I said this, I think publicly, I certainly said it to the head of OEA. I was waiting for that moment when they were presented an item and they did their due diligence and said, you know what? The costs don't justify, the benefits don't justify the cost, and we shouldn't do this path. And it never happened on my watch. I'm hoping at some point it does, because that means then the process actually works in my mind. But we'll just have to see.
Jane or Chris, do you have any comments on that?
I was just thinking about sort of the quirkiness of this case in particular when we start talking about economic analysis and such things. It was the 2002 order that tried to put a really extreme economic box in how to define how you would have rules that would work and not. And they had a whole diversity index and a whole lot of other things that went with it that the Third Circuit shut down in the first place. And said, this is, you know, and there were some flaws in that. Let me be clear there. But that was probably the most serious effort that I think that the commission ever tried to look at these local ownership rules and put some economic framework around it and figure out how they were going to how they could go forward. And it got shot down. So, you know, again, we went through this process and years later, here we are. Saying, okay, what are the rules? What do you have to have, agency? You have to ask people to help you. You got to hope people will give you something that's pretty good. You got to do your best to sort it all out. And then if you do all of that and explain it in more than two sentences, you're going to be okay.
Chris?
Well, perhaps turning a little bit to sort of the issue, I guess what this triggers in my mind now, of course, we've got a different commission. And it's entitled to a great deal of deference too. So what should it do in terms of further analyzing this issue? And of course, it has to keep analyzing the issue at least every 4 years. And I think we'd all be better off if the commission had good data and could analyze it. I'm forgetting the name of the latest form that is supposed to, you know, obtain ownership information about broadcasting stations. And the main thing I know is that it's everyone seems to agree that prior to about 10 or 12 years ago, the data collection was not reliable. I don't know whether the new data is reliable. You know, if it is on some level with respect to this issue, it ought to be possible to take a look at, see what, you know, there'll be some consolidation under this round of rules, presumably, and I hope it is at least, just doesn't sound all that complicated to figure out. So did that round of consolidation have any effect on minority and women ownership or not? And maybe we can actually get some useful empirical information this time around.
Well, let me ask you guys sort of one last sort of generic question, which I think will lead me into the second part of our discussion. But again, you know, there's a ruling dealing with all commission rulemakings, so, you know, agencies. So, you know, we talked about, and Mike, you brought this up, you know, the need for cost-benefit analysis, and the FCC, when they established Austin Analytics, they deliberately incorporated the OMB Circular A4, which requires a cost-benefit analysis. Obviously, the FCC is an independent agency and not part of the executive branch. But literally one of the first things that President Biden did coming into office is he revised OMB Circular A4. Now, although they still require a cost-benefit analysis, an agency must also ensure that the regulation, quote, promotes public health and safety, economic growth, social welfare, racial justice, environmental stewardship, human dignity, equity, and the interest of future generations. While these all might be worthy and aspirational goals, I can tell you that our economics team are asking, how does one measure that, particularly in a rule? So again, how do we think that the court's ruling with this deference, because you can now see that the Biden administration is really untethering from cost-benefit analysis to include, how should we put it, non-economic factors with the deference. Do we see the rise of the administrative state of this, if the court is really sort of, again, sort of putting its, you know, it's imprimatur and increased deference to agencies? Jane, what do you think?
I'm not quite sure how to answer that one. I think it's a good point. You throw out a whole lot of other factors and you try to put them in and say, and put them into boxes, say, well, this is a cost benefit analysis, but a bunch of the costs that you might be trying to identify are very hard to quantify. And when you can't quantify costs or benefits, I'm not sure how you get to a reasonable conclusion. And that's just going to put you back in the courts where they're going to say, well, this looks good to us or it doesn't look good to us somewhere along the way. And I'm not sure that's all that different. So.
Right. Chris, what do you think?
Yeah. So I guess this is similar to what Jane said in the sense that, you know, there are, I like numbers myself, but there are hard to quantify costs and benefits that are very important as well. And, you know, for better or worse, I think the number crunching is very important, but it's never going to be everything that is necessary. And, you know, with respect to the particular statute we have here, where since 1934, the public interest has been what matters. And, you know, that's obviously a broad, flexible phrase, and different commissions have put different emphases on it, you know, forever. And of course, the world is changing. So it's never going to be easy to determine what's in the public interest, and courts have to give the FCC a certain amount of latitude, I think. But, you know, ultimately, we can hope that every commission will do a good job of trying to get what data it can and do an honest job of sort of what's, you know, what are these non-quantifiable costs and benefits, and explaining how they weigh them, and you know, judges will have to simultaneously be somewhat deferential, but I guess, you know, not so deferential that just sort of, if you say in two sentences, you know, here's what we're going to do, and we make a predictive judgment that things will be better if we do them. You know, she said that just can't be enough.
And you also can't put it in a footnote.
Right.
That's a good rule, too.
The old no footnote rule.
Yeah. Larry, can I just add to the point? Like, if I didn't think that cost benefit was benefit analysis was being done before, I certainly don't think that after you add all these factors, anything is going to be done going forward. And so that's just how it is going to be. And we, you know, move on and just accept it for what it is.
All right. Well, now let's turn to part two. Quick, the implications of the case on the next quadrennial review. You know, without a doubt, I think everybody can agree it was certainly a victory for Chairman Pai. And, you know, but to me, I think the real question is it a Pyrrhic victory? As Jane and Mike and Chris have all pointed out, by the express terms of the statute, it is a quadrennial review. So we are coming back to this. It is not going away. Now, as I said at the beginning of our webinar, the majority ran for the hills, speaking of footnotes, Jane, and did not want to touch with a 10-foot pole the issue of whether Section 202H requires the commission to consider women and minority ownership. They put that into a footnote. They said, we're not dealing with it. Forget it. However, in his concurrence, Justice Thomas argued very forcefully that the answer to this question is no. He pointed out, which is actually a point I kind of made in my amicus brief, that from its quote, from its infancy, the FCC has focused on consumers, not producers. So we're coming back here. The issue over minority, whether the FCC has to consider women minority, the effect of women minority, effective deregulation on women minority owners has not been answered. What's going to happen when the next quadrennial review comes up? And Jane, I'll start with you, please.
Okay. I think that it's going to be much the same as we've seen before. When commissions change, the attitude and focus of the policies has a way of changing as well. And so each particular commission is going to look at this and say, okay, is this important? Is this aspect of the matter more important or less important? It's the same thing we were just talking about a moment ago. You're weighing what you think of as a factor. Now, I think Justice Thomas's concurrence was interesting, focusing several times on this notion that what the commission was doing was using as all of these things as a proxy for what is viewpoint diversity and the importance of viewpoint diversity. But I think that that proxy factor is still there. And I expect that this commission is going to focus on it.
Chris?
Yeah, right. I you know, this opinion leaves us where we are, sort of the same way the net neutrality decision seemed to have done, that sort of the next administration has a broad area in which to move. And, you know, I know the court simply didn't reach it, as it said in footnote 3, but, you know, I don't think the court would reach it and find that the public interest has to require, that the commission doesn't consider the effect of its rule changes on various issues relating to viewpoint diversity, of which I think female and minority ownership is one. So, you know, I expect this next commission to adopt a different reading of Section 202H, one that emphasizes that the provision twice talks about the public interest without limitation, that it was adopted in 1996, just 1 year after the commission issued under Chairman Reed, the Reed Hunt a position paper saying that, you know, minority and female ownership is part of our, an important part of our analysis of media ownership. And so that will be the interpretation, you know, up to until we have yet another commission or until Congress musters a majority to, you know, get something more definite than public interest.
That's not going to happen.
Yeah. Okay. Larry, can I answer it slightly different?
Please.
And say, I agree with the analysis from both Jane and Chris, but I would say, what's the, I don't know if I'm preempting a question you're coming, but what's the practical impact of the decision? The three items, or the two that the court, you know, the commission struck down and eliminated, and the one that's been modified. Do I believe the current commission, as it's constructed, or, you know, when they get to full majority, are going to change those? I don't. I don't think that's where they're going to spend their time revisiting newspaper cross-ownership or radio television cross-ownership. I just don't see that being, you know, even trying to reinstitute some kind of test for female and minority ownership. And then you say, okay, well, what's left? You know, radio, some of the local television market ownership is left. The national cap remains outside the quadrennial. I mean, this is, I would have liked to have gone further. You know, you can see where I wanted to go when we were doing the quadrennials, that when I was there, but I'm not sure that, you know, you're going to get much significance in the next commission in terms of where, you know, trying to reinstitute this. They're not, I don't see them putting the three rules back in place that have been modified and changed and eliminated. And then I don't see them ever approving, you know, the current commission ever approving any further changes, just like the last many Democratic commissions didn't approve any changes. So it's kind of, you know, it is what it is. And then until we get to another commission where there's a different, you know, completely different mindset, a different, you know, administration, then I think we're, you know, this is where we are. That's the practical impact of the case, I would say.
Well, let me ask you, all three of you, sort of a slight variation of this. Going back to the phrase that Chris has raised very often during our conversation today, the notion of the predictive judgment, Chris. You know, the Third Circuit in its dissent said, look, you know, the quadra review is supposed to be an iterative process. So if you get rid of the rules, then in 3.5 or 4 years, I guess what it is, you then can have data. You can then construct a counterfactual and look and see if there's an effect. So, but given where everything is with this case, do you think they're actually going to try and actually look at data, or we're back to the predictive judgment problem? Because there's not, I doubt there's going to be that much data happening in 2.5, 3 years. Or Jane, what do you think of that?
I mean, I think that's right. I don't think there's going to be much data that's going to come about. But I also agree with what Mike just said, is I don't see any possibility that this commission has any interest in reinstating the newspaper cross-ownership rule. I think that one, it took a long time, but I think it's gone. Radio television cross-ownership may be something, but I can't think of why that would be either. So, you know, it seems to me that this commission will look at what they see happening as a result of these rules, but I actually don't think it's going to be much.
So for the record, I'd just like to note that I think there's a very strong case to be made for getting rid of the newspaper broadcast cross-ownership rule. And that's
has been for years.
So let me give you a hypothetical. Suppose there's massive consolidation.
No, it's reciprocal, is it? Okay.
Can I give you a hypothetical?
Sure.
You know, over the next 2 years, there is massive consolidation. And the FCC looks at the data and says, you know, my goodness, minority ownership by our count went down from 8% to 0.5%, and female ownership was the same. Should the commission do something? Would this commission do something, assuming it's got 5 members? I mean, I think it would. I don't think that's, you know, any dramatic change like that is liable to happen, but who knows?
But it doesn't have to be in the form of ownership rules, which I think is what one of the points that has been made here. is that, yes, the commission should look at these things. The commission should try to take action. And in fact, the commission did. And oddly, in this case, with the incubator order, it was the Third Circuit that killed the incubator order, and which made no sense. And so, you know, what have you got going forward? Is that it seems to me that you have to look at sort of the practical effects of it, as Mike said.
I understand
your license transfers. Yeah. So,
well, I agree to Chris's point in terms of the hypothetical. You know, I just being more practical, I would just say I don't anticipate a bunch of broadcasters buying newspapers. So I see that being hard. And I think even, you know, and they have, as Larry just pointed out, the license transfer in the local market, you know, combining a one and a two, I think is probably not going to be in the cards. A three and a four is going to be, you know, is probably, you know, a tough sell maybe in this commission. There'll be some that get through depending on the circumstances, and they'll have complete deference in that universe. So I just don't see a scenario where they want to undo what's, you know, and try and reinstate some of those things when they have enough authority to kind of deal with some of it elsewhere. It just seems like a unnecessary time suck, given where the market is today. I mean, just nobody wants newspapers. And then the solution to Jane's point is absolutely dead on. If there is a remedy to be had, the solution isn't to reinstate the rules. It is to look at other mechanisms. And the incubator, it does have its flaws in the sense that if you're considering it, you know, its impact or the rule on television, it's a radio incubator. So yeah, there's probably some fixes that needs to be done, but the remedy should be considered different than just reinstating the old rules in my mind. And I think that would bear out in terms of, you know, it's been so long since that was the remedy in the 70s in most of these instances, and they didn't make sense then, much less now.
So I just have to note that, you know, I read a lot of arguments and briefs in this case about how terrible these rules were and how they were preventing a whole lot of good things from happening. And so if there's any merit to that, there is going to be some consolidation, right?
There'll be some. I agree. And I think strategic deals are possible. But I've talked to broadcasters during my time and asked them, how many of you are going to buy newspapers? And not a lot of hands go up. So
the horse left the barn on that one a while ago.
Well, let me ask you this, because, of course, it all brings it all back to this. Let us assume, and it's great hearing Mike's political insight on this, but as those who love both laws and sausages shall inquire, neither are made. Let's just assume, for the sake of argument, that the commission does, the politics are so much, you know, these are strange times we're all living in, and they feel compelled to do something, or even just issue a formal denial. No, we're not going to issue rules. Okay, so here's the big question. What's the over-under that the commission wants to keep it away from the Third Circuit, right? Where, I mean, how do
99-1?
Yeah. How do you keep, you know, if it ends back in the Third Circuit, there's a lottery. Is it deja vu all over again? I mean, this is how my brain works. I can see this endless loop of, oh my God, we're back to the Third Circuit. And then they're vindictive again. We're all back to this whole, you know, production. Yes.
You can't have the same panel again. That would be way too much of a coincidence. The panel, even if it goes back there, it should be a different panel. Hopefully somebody's retired, maybe. But
from your mouth to God's ears, Jane.
I don't see how you can read that decision and argue that the Third Circuit still has jurisdiction over the case, or they can try to assert it. And the idea that, you know, on the lottery, that would be like the worst, you know, luck for the commission, if you're spinning the, you know, or the ping pong balls in terms of, you know, I would imagine it goes back to DC Circuit, which had a piece. And then, it, you know, in the recent case, and that was, you know, then jumbled into the Third Circuit. So I'd have a hard time thinking the Third Circuit gets its, you know, its muddy paws on this again.
Well, it could by virtue of the lottery process. I mean, if you have the multi-circuit, you know, jurors, whatever that thing is called, it could wind up there. But to be of the same panel, I think would just be way, way too much.
So haven't at least a couple of the other ones, actually the ping pong ball landed somewhere other
than
the Third Circuit?
It landed in the D.C. Circuit in one of the times that I was dealing with.
Right. The courts are of two minds, and yet, you know, one of which is, well, any court ought to be able to read the prior decision and judge the agency's order against it. But the other is, you know, three judges have invested a lot of time in learning about an area, should take advantage of that experience and not, you know, require other judges to spend a whole lot of their time doing it too. And, you know, I as a lawyer in private practice, I'm very careful and determine which situation is best for my client before deciding whether we think transfer is permissible or not. But, you know, but I honestly don't know if sort of a pure public interest hat. There is some merit to both of those positions.
But didn't the decision just scream out, you got it wrong, Third Circuit? You know, this is, it's very clear. It's very clear that the court, you know, and a 9-0 decision, and who knows where the lines would have broken down if, you know, were there more votes for the Thomas opinion, if they wanted to do a 5-4 instead of a 9-0, that's unclear. Right. And so that's what you'll never see and they'll never talk about, but it's hard. It's very hard to see where the Third Circuit says, yeah, we'd like this case again. That was a great experience. We'd love to do this again if we could. They got rightfully, in my opinion, spanked in this decision. And I think that they would be just move on to other things in their careers and be appropriate action.
That's our panel. We don't work blue here, Commissioner. All right. Well, we have a few more minutes. Nick, do we have any questions if people want to ask?
For our attendees, if you've got a question, I'd encourage you to submit them via chat or the Q&A function to Larry, and he'll screen them and take a look. But Larry, back to you.
All right. Well, we've got about literally 2 minutes, so let's just go around the horn with some final thoughts. Jane, let's start with you just real quick. What have we learned from this entire process here, and where do we go?
From the entire process, I think that we've learned that it's a good idea to have different courts review something, because I think this one did take way too long, and I do think that was something that it was unfair to almost all of the parties involved. To have it be something that lasted this long. And I think the Supreme Court rightfully took the case. They decided on narrow grounds because they just didn't want to go any further. And that's I'm hoping that that's where we end it.
Okay, Chris?
So we've got another decision, you know, in my mind, expanding the amount of deference that agencies give or get, rather, in a way that doesn't seem entirely helpful to me, like judicial review that's not toothless, and this comes pretty close to it. But, and on the merits of this, then we're back we're back in the position we've been in many others. And, you know, I suppose one spin is elections have consequences. So a new administration comes in, it ought to be able to have some latitude to do what it likes. On the other hand, it is a little frustrating that things go up and down, and you have the feeling it's more due to the predilection of the decision maker rather than the merits of the issue.
Right. Sure.
Look, and I look at this case as putting a nail in the coffin into a bunch of rules that shouldn't, you know, have lived as long as they did. You know, the grander piece of jurisdictional authority of the commission, I probably share some of Chris's concern. But this is just one of those screaming for resolution. And I'm so thankful that the court took it up and got to this point. And now I'd like to, you know, I believe that in the next, you know, I don't know, 10 years, they'll actually do the rest of the rules. And we can actually recognize what's happening in the marketplace and how competitive it is for broadcasters to survive. And so we'll just have to see if that's the case. I'm not optimistic in the near term.
All right. We're at the top of the hour. I want to thank our guests, Jane Mago, Chris Wright, Commissioner Michael Riley, for an excellent discussion. Thank you so much. And Nick, I will throw it to you for final goodbyes.
Thanks very much, Larry. So just a quick thanks on behalf of the Federalist Society to all of you, our panelists, for your time and expertise this afternoon. Of course, to Larry for helping organize this, run the show. It was all in your court, so we appreciate that. To our audience for calling in, connecting. Sorry we didn't get to questions at the end, but do tune in again. Check your emails and our website for announcements about upcoming Teleforum calls, upcoming Zoom programs like this. We've got a few next week covering some different court decisions. We've got a panel on original public meaning versus framers' intent. So we're covering all kinds of ground next week. Be sure to check that out. Also, save the date. The week of May 17th, we're having our all-virtual Executive Branch Review Week conference. We'll have virtual panels about 2 to 4 each day, all week, through Thursday. So be sure to check that out on our website as well. Okay, and with that, thanks all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.